So these are my two questions. There we go. 68-year-old male presents with a metastatic melanoma involving the left level 2 node. Patient has no significant history of skin cancer, sun exposure, or prior dermatologic care. Common theories of sources for the metastatic melanoma include the following, and I'm asking you to pick which is the most likely. So immune surveillance led to spontaneous regression of the primary, prior excision of a lesion not recognized as a melanoma, develop of ectopic melanocytes into metastatic disease within the neck node, which is thought to occur during spread of melanocytes from the notochord in utero, and then lastly, an undetected uveal melanoma primary. The envelope, please. So again, the first three are all theoretically correct, but they're hard to prove, and particularly in this patient who has no prior dermatologic care. So I would say actually D, it's the undetected uveal melanoma primary. Next. 24-year-old white male presents with testicular carcinoma of the left testes with involvement of the retroperitoneal mediastinal left neck basin. Patient is treated with multimodality chemotherapy, is scheduled for left-modified radical neck dissection for residual lymphadenopathy in the left neck. Potential complications of this procedure, each of the following except, so chyle duct leak, phrenic nerve, injury to the junction of the internal jugular vein with the subclavian vein, and then hypoglossal nerve injury. So D is correct, 41%, and that's due to the fact that we typically don't need to dissect up to level 2. The dissection is limited to levels kind of 3, 4, and 5, the lower neck, supraclavicular neck. My slides, please. And again, I'm really grateful to AV. You've done a great job of switching back and forth today. Got it. So if quotation and mimicry is the greatest form of flattery, both of my prior speakers will see a great deal of adulation during my talk. But a lot of this was intentional because we really feel like we're stressing important concepts that we really want you as the audience to take home with you. I will say, as chair of the Otolaryngology Advisory Council for the college, it's very heartening to see this type of attendance today, and thank you for being here. And it lets me and my committee know that we're doing the right we're making the right efforts on behalf of the college and its membership. I also have no financial relationships to disclose. So this is a quote that's in my brain over 30 years old. This is my former chief at the Cleveland Clinic, Harvey Tucker. And he would say a lateral neck mass in an adult is cancer until proven otherwise. He would then go on to say that it wasn't uniformly cancer in all adults, but if you took this diagnostic approach, you were going to benefit far more patients than you would ever potentially harm. And as has already been alluded to, and I'll try to avoid keep saying to allude to or quote either or Dan or Eric, we have to have a broad differential diagnosis, including neoplastic, inflammatory, and infectious disease. And if you notice in this woman right here, and I'm having trouble with the pointer on the slide, but there, thank you, Dan. You can see what was
the green at the top.
These bifocal lesions that when a needle biopsy that had been done of a deeper neck mass was thought to be a sarcoma. And so this woman was actually scheduled for a thoracocervical resection of a sarcoma, and it just didn't make sense to me. And on the day of her surgery, I did an open neck biopsy, and it ended up being scrofula. So we avoided what would have been a debilitating and devastating operation, both for the patient and myself. And again, I just think that these types of cases are so illustrative, and they virtually stick with you forever. And so, again, when we see lesions in the neck, we have to think of this very broad differential. So metastatic disease from any source. And so I was editor for the case report section of Head and Neck Surgery for the better part of a decade earlier in my career. And I would call that section the section of metastatic disease from the infraclavicular region, because I would get this inordinate number of case reports. We've already heard about squamous carcinoma, both primary and metastatic salivary gland disease, lymphoma. So I just had a fellow from Australia, and we would do a lymph node biopsy. As we opened the neck, the first thing that he would say to me is, "Hey, Dan, doesn't that look like fish flesh to you?" And to me, you know, that's a great description. You know, when you get in there and you look at something that's got the equivalence of a white fish flesh, that is most often lymphoma. It's already been alluded to talking about thyroid disease, neuroendocrine, metastatic skin cancer, neurovascular tumor, sarcoma, and again, infraclavicular metastasis. So all of this has to be part of your broad differential diagnosis. And the one thing that I would add to the two previous talks is the concept of phenotype. So these are the three broad groups that I use. And this is a gentleman who I'd previously cared for, his sister, who presented with an advanced oral cavity cancer, and she lived for about 10 years and eventually died of the sequelae of her disease. And this is actually him after a right parotidectomy neck dissection for metastatic squamous carcinoma. And you can see that this patient is going to be at risk for all different types of metastatic diseases. This patient could have a Merkel cell, he could have a melanoma, he could have a metastatic squamous carcinoma, and that all has to be part of your differential as you see him with a either isolated neck or parotid mass. And I talked about these types of differential diagnosis for metastatic malignant melanoma, and these are kind of the three prevailing theories of how this can develop with no true primary. But it is important to exclude potential primary sites. So in the head and neck, that would include uveal, sinonasal, oral cavity, and upper air digestive tract. And again, early in my career, I saw a patient with metastatic disease to the left level 2 neck. And when we did an endoscopy on this patient, he actually had a supraglottic primary. So rare cases, but they do occur. So again, the diagnosis that you never consider will be the one you never make, and it needs to be part of the workup of this patient population. The HPV negative patient alluded to in both of the earlier lectures, the smoking and drinking patient, and as Dan illustrated, tongue primary would not be uncommon in this patient. And then lastly, the new face of HPV disease. And again, I give Mr. Douglas credit for being public about this and really trying to be part of the solution and not, you know, kind of whisk this under the rug. He's been a very active advocate for early detection and treatment of this disease. So again, this is a map to me of the neck that is really critical. And I think in many ways, it may be the way to best sum up my component of the lecture. So we see patients who have skin cancer who will have prefacial lymph nodes. Level 1 is usually oral cavity type lesions. It can either be squamous carcinoma or a minor salivary gland. You can never forget the parotid because it's the only salivary gland that actually has lymph nodes embedded in the gland, and this can be the site of metastatic disease from a host of skin primaries, again, whether that's Merkel, melanoma, I've seen it in eccrine-type cancers, but not an uncommon site. Level 2 is really the most significant kind of landing basis, and it's jugulodigastric, and that can be anything from any component of upper air digestive tract to being thyroid to lymphoma, et cetera. As Dan alluded to, posterior cervical, again, a lot of those patients will end up presenting with skin cancer, and then supraclavicular, again, host of diagnoses including thyroid cancer, as well as a number of infraclavicular diseases, many of which we will end up helping to manage this patient population. So at my prior home at Sloan Kettering, I took care of a majority of the patients who had metastatic testicular carcinoma. There were also the rare gynecologic patients who would require cervical cleanouts. There was even one patient with an isolated breast metastasis who failed multimodality therapy, and at the request of the chief of medical oncology and breast cancer, I did a neck dissection to control that disease. So again, it was discussed earlier, but what do you do with the classic mass sitting right at the angle of the mandible? And I think these two X-ray studies will illustrate that. So this is a patient with a known squamous carcinoma of the skin. He now has a metastasis to the tail of the parotid, and this patient will require a parotidectomy and neck dissection. You contrast that to this patient who essentially, really on physical exam, has almost an identical physical exam, and yet their angle of the mandible lesion is a jugular digastric lymph node that is actually deep to the parotid. And even in the most seasoned of hands, this can often be challenging to make the diagnosis, and imaging will often provide us with valuable insight. And then lastly, in the head and neck, you can't forget the retropharyngeal lymph nodes. This was a patient who was undergoing the typical tinnitus workup. This is the last scan working from superior to inferior. Retropharyngeal node was identified, and we actually identified an early stage nasopharynx cancer based on this retropharyngeal node. Dan's already talked to you about the importance of needle biopsy. Both speakers have, and I'm not going to belabor that. Cytologic evaluation is critical, and again, already discussed, but all of these different tests can provide valuable insights. So flow cytometry for melanoma, the many immunohistochemistries that increasingly are proliferated, the use of HMB-45, S100 for melanoma, cytokeratins associated with squamous carcinoma, calcitonin for medullary thyroid cancer, thyroglobulin for well-differentiated thyroid cancer, the different CD studies, mucicarmine as part of a salivary workup. Eric talked very eloquently about use of P16 and HPV surrogates. And increasingly, we're seeing a role for molecular markers in this era of molecular therapy. And it plays a role both in the diagnostic and therapeutic evaluation and consideration of these patients. So I want to present a case that, again, I think is a little different from what you've already heard. Patient that was provided care by our multidisciplinary team for a mid-thoracic esophageal carcinoma and presented with a level 2 neck mass. And so really our differential diagnosis focused on either an atypical metastasis to level 2 or a new primary. And so you see the uptake in the neck mass. And look at this. You see this small primary in the piriform sinus. And you see this retropharyngeal node. And so this patient was a candidate for re-irradiation with chemotherapy. There was no overlap from the previous treatment portals. It was HPV negative on needle biopsy, as we would often expect. And he's free of disease about 4 years out now since treatment. This is the classic Rustovin study. It's getting a little old and long in the tooth, but that being said, it's still valid. And ultimately, we're able to identify the primary in roughly about 25% of patients. And we see additional regional and or distant metastatic disease identified in up to another quarter of patients. So the PET scan really plays an integral role. And I would call it one of the great innovations that has occurred during the course of my career in clinical medicine. As already been discussed, operative consent, biopsy, neck dissection, multiple endoscopies is critical. And one of my cases is illustrative for that. But this is the type of patient we're discussing. This was actually the last patient enrolled in RTOG 3311, the robotic trial with de-escalation of therapy. This was someone who I had taken care of his son for another head and neck disease. Came into the office, 2 negative needle biopsies. And I happened to mention to him and his wife that in the remote chance that this ended up being metastatic squamous carcinoma, that I would do a neck dissection and an endoscopy. In fact, this was positive for metastatic HPV-positive squamous carcinoma. I did an immediate neck dissection. We found a small tonsil primary. He had tonsillectomy. And the really neat thing about this patient was that he was randomized to no treatment and is free of disease. And so he's part of the active follow-up and surveillance component of that trial and is doing well. As already been alluded to, open biopsy can be significantly morbid and potentially can impact upon mortality. Very early in my career, in spite of excising a scar, I had a young man who, after neck dissection, presented with a combination of scar recurrence as well as a metastatic lesion to his ribs, and that lives with you. It impacts upon our ability to perform functional neck dissection, increases the incidence of cranial neuropathy and salvage neck dissection, impacts upon incision design, cosmesis, and may ultimately impact upon treatment of the primary. And I'm going to give you two vivid examples. This is a young woman who had an open neck biopsy with a large component of residual disease. And my concern was her facial nerve. And in fact, the upper component of her disease actually extended to here. I identified her lower division of her facial nerve. In my opinion, had I not done that, I would have cut her lower division, as disease was just inferior to the pes. Similarly, this is someone who had approached by a vascular surgeon, and the problem was that this patient didn't require a completion neck dissection, and so we ended up designing an incision that looked like this and this, and my fellow called this gentleman the Mark of Zorro. He was a Z. But we want to avoid these types of both cosmetically and potentially functionally debilitating approaches. I still think that type 3 modified radical neck dissection is the workhorse. We are routinely able to preserve the sternocleidomastoid muscle, the spinal accessory nerve. You can see here incorporation of level 2B, which is important in a number of disease systems and a number of biologies of tumors, in a way that we incorporate all at-risk nodal basins. And you can see here preserving the nerve. And again, it's really important as the senior surgeon on the case that you direct your assistance, because this is not liver surgery. More retraction is not better, and you can anatomically preserve this nerve and physiologically denervate it. And as others have alluded to, increasingly I use nerve monitoring, particularly in any form of a professional athlete in which spinal accessory nerve function may be critical. We also preserve the internal jugular vein, and you can see that here. And this is oncologically a good operation. You can see here one of the last papers that I published at Memorial looked at 130 patients undergoing type 3 modified radical neck dissection, and that you can see that ultimately we only had 5% of patients who developed recurrence in the dissected neck without significant disease elsewhere. So again, I think that it's oncologically feasible, and it really impacts upon your patients. And this is the ultimate metric, which is shoulder function. And you can see here, this was actually a prospective randomized placebo-controlled study done at Memorial. It was funded by the NIH using acupuncture for pain and dysfunction. And we actually had a dummy unit in which each of these patients went to acupuncture and either received the stimulation or no stimulation. And a fascinating part of it was when we had a questionnaire to ask them if they had gotten the needle or not for acupuncture. It was basically random. They were guessing. It was 50-50. And ultimately, you can see that strength and pain were improved in the group that got acupuncture. So again, we don't always understand how acupuncture works. There's some active investigation using functional MRI, but we can see the outcome that it does seem to impact this population of patients in a good way. The last thing I want to mention is, I've alluded to this, is management of the lower neck. And the critical structures are the phrenic nerves. So this has often been a common question on the oral boards about the structure at the greatest risk for an anterior scalene lymph node biopsy in the general surgery boards. But we all know also that the brachial plexus, carotid sheath structures, thoracic duct, and the junction of the internal jugular vein with the subclavian vein are all at significant risk. And so here you can see the takeoff of the brachial plexus. Here's the carotid sheath structures. And then you can just see this faint hint of the phrenic nerve. And then this is actually a phrenic nerve. And the reason I included this is that this has a really nice depiction of that distal branch of the thoracoacromial artery. And if you're not careful about that, that'll start spewing blood. And what happens is that everyone in the room picks up a clamp. And the first thing I'll do in that instance is I'll actually put my finger over that, because the only thing that they're going to clamp is me. I really want to avoid. If you have ever had a patient with phrenic nerve injury, it can be very debilitating. And you really, it's where you have to kind of readjust the case, get everybody in tune, and make sure that you don't perform phrenectomy. So I think that's really a critical component. And again, you can see really nicely here the phrenic nerve on the anterior scalene, and the origin of the brachial plexus was a recent low neck dissection that I was performing. So in summary, I would say that eternal vigilance in the patient is in the neck mass is the most important skill and knowledge set that we bring. We have seen and heard about the emergence of HPV disease, and I think it's really imperative that we undergo this thorough stepwise progression of diagnostic workup prior to the opening of the neck. Thank you. My daughter in Chiang Mai, Thailand, taking care of elephants in an elephant rehabilitation camp, and then the famous Fiona, the baby hippo, in Cincinnati. I understand Fiona is an internet star and phenomenon.